This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily via the internet address www.parstoday.com/en. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Intelsat 902, and Eutelsat satellite, as well as via internet. You can also listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for more details.
Please listen to verses 9 to 11 of chapter Hud from the Holy Quran, recited by Mr. Sayyid Ahmad Mirzadeh Waqifi.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim. وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَا الْإِنسَانَ مِنَّا رَحْمَةً ثُمَّ نَزَعْنَاهَا وَلَئِنْ أَذَقْنَاهُ نَعْمَاءَ بَعْدَ ضَرَّاءَ مَسَّتْهُ لَيَقُولَنَّ ذَهَبَ السَّيِّئَاتُ عَنِّي إِنَّهُ لَفَرِحٌ فَخُورٌ إِلَّا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير إلا الذين صبروا وعملوا الصالحات أولئك لهم مغفرة وأجر كبير. صدق الله العلي.
In the name of God, the most compassionate, the most merciful. And if we make man taste mercy from us, then take it off from him, most surely he is despairing, ungrateful. And if we make him taste a favor after distress has afflicted him, he will certainly say, "The evils are gone away from me." Most surely, he is exulting, boasting. Except those who are patient and do good. They shall have forgiveness and a great reward.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.
A gunman kills at least 10 people, including a police officer at a grocery store in the U.S. state of Colorado. Israelis begin voting in their fourth election in less than 2 years, with voters still divided over whether Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu deserves to remain in office. Germany reverses plans to reopen economy and will enter a strict 5-day shutdown in a bid to break a third wave of the COVID-19 pandemic.
This is World News coming to you live from the Iranian capital, Tehran. It's good to have you. Beginning with our top story, 10 people, including a police officer, have been killed in a shooting incident at a supermarket in the U.S. city of Boulder, Colorado. Local police forces, as well as FBI officers, were dispatched to the scene to respond to, quote, an armed and dangerous individual. The injured suspect has been taken into custody. The police say the threat has been eliminated. There's no immediate information on the shooter's identity or motive, but an investigation has been launched into the incident. The United States loses around 33,000 people to gun violence every year. Additionally, more than 100,000 people are shot each year in the country. Former member of the U.S. Marshals Service Matthew Fox says easy access to firearms is the main culprit for shooting incidents in the U.S.
Well, I mean, it's just like all the rest of them. We've had quite a few in the United States over the last few years. The bottom line is there are a lot of guns on the streets in the United States. People have access to guns. You know, the concern is a lot of people are anxieties out there. A lot of people are taking out their feelings on going out there trying to do whatever it is, vigilante style. In this particular case, they're doing an investigation, so they don't really know. They're saying they don't really know the motive yet. But, I mean, in the close proximity of the Asian killing, I don't know if this here had anything to do with race, but the bottom line is you got so many people dead, and you got a person that just went in and started shooting. And in the United States, we have so many open facilities where people can just come in with a gun and start firing. That can happen, and we've been seeing it over and over again.
New photos have emerged showing the squalid conditions of immigrants being kept at a processing center near the U.S.-Mexico border. Migrants could be seen crowding together and sleeping on the floor at the border facility in Donna, Texas. The photos come amid criticism of U.S. President Joe Biden's policy regarding immigration, as record numbers of asylum seekers have been flooding into the country. The White House is particularly under fire for the conditions in overcrowded detention centers for unaccompanied immigrant children. More than 10,000 kids, including many of those forcibly separated from their parents, are now in the care of the Department of Health and Human Services. 5,000 others are also stranded in border patrol facilities not designed for long-term custody, that is. Earlier, we were joined by our correspondent in Washington, D.C., Colin Campbell, who told us more about the immigrant crisis at the United States border with Mexico. Here's more.
The fact of the matter is, there is an issue happening at the border. Some would characterize it as a crisis. As we're getting more people who are coming to the border, there are less facilities to process these people who want to come in. And of course, this can create crisis-like conditions. And it's up to the Biden administration to really do something about this. This is really bad for the administration, especially since a lot of people voted for the current administration because of the atrocities that happened from the last administration. And some would say were caused by the previous administration before that, the Obama administration, that created some of these detention facilities that some would characterize as less than humane. And so what we have is a situation at the border where you have an influx of people with very few places to go. Sometimes children are just coming across looking for a new opportunity, and they don't have there's no way or proper process to get these children through and get them either asylum or to put them through the due process to get them any kind of citizenship. It's just not happening.
Israelis are heading to the polls to cast ballots in the fourth general election in less than 2 years. The latest opinion polls have suggested a continued political deadlock there. None of the Israeli bloc seemed likely to secure the required 61 seats for forming a cabinet. The election comes as Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu is on trial for corruption and faced criticism over his COVID response. Netanyahu has two main opponents. One is Gideon Saar, the leader of Israel's New Hope Party. Another rival is Naftali Bennett, the chairman of the far-right Yamina Party. Netanyahu has remained in power since first inconclusive elections in 2019, based on an emergency agreement. Now, to discuss that story further, I'm joined by Mona Kandel, our correspondent in Ramallah. Mona, it's good to talk to you. Tell us more about the election.
Well, it's Israel's unprecedented fourth election in 2 years, and experts are speaking about possible fifth election. At this time, none of the Israeli parties succeeded in getting more than half of the 120 seats in the Knesset. There are several scenarios. The first scenario they are speaking about that there are four parties. There's the Likud, Chas, United Torah, and Judaism, religious Zionism. Those have commitments to support the Netanyahu-led regime. However, as you were speaking, there is Naftali Bennett's Yamina. He's calling for a change. And here experts are saying that Netanyahu has lost some of his supporters, like Naftali Bennett. And there is Gideon Saar as well calling for a change. So Netanyahu's chances are the same like the three previous elections. But experts are saying there might be a change because the Israelis are fed up from the election. Every several months, they go to cast their ballots. And especially now with the spread of the coronavirus, the issue has become more difficult on them. Netanyahu, in a way or another, the Israelis had been going to the streets every Saturday for more than 20 consecutive weeks, calling him to leave, to completely leave the political scene and not to continue to be the Israeli prime minister. They are calling for him to be tried for the several charges against him. He's being charged for fraud, for several issues inside Israel.
Mona, if Benjamin Netanyahu remains in power, will he be able to form a cabinet, given the fact that in three earlier rounds of elections, the stable majority proved to be elusive for him?
Well, the final polls in Israel suggested that rival parties are neck to neck to the in this upcoming general election, and there is the greatest challenge to Netanyahu, as I said, from Naftali Bennett and also from Gideon Saar. They are a very popular alternative to Netanyahu. But this time, if he wins the majority, but he won't be able to form his own cabinet, then he will try to convince, as the last time, to convince other smaller parties to form a unity cabinet. This won't be easy, but at the same time, he can manage this. Or the other scenario would be, according to experts, heading to a fifth election. And this is possible because the Israelis, according to the polls, they don't want Netanyahu to stay in power anymore.
And finally, can the outcome of this election have any meaningful change or impact effect on the Israeli-Palestinian conflict?
No, the Palestinian Authority has made it clear that whoever will be the Israeli prime minister and whatever would be the form of the next Israeli regime or the Israeli cabinet, nothing will change on ground, because the Israeli officials compete in order to show who's more aggressive to the Palestinians and who will be allowing the settlers to confiscate more lands and build Israeli settlements and annex the confiscated lands to the Israeli illegal settlements. So Netanyahu or any other Israeli official, nothing would change. However, it's more obvious that Netanyahu is clear in his hatred and aggressive manners towards the Palestinians.
I want to thank you so much for the details. That was Mona Candil, our correspondent in Ramallah. Now, moving on, Germany says it will impose a strict 5-day shutdown over the Easter holidays next week to contain a third wave of coronavirus.
We are at a place where we are now in a very, very serious situation. The 1st and 3rd of April will be designated one of quiet days with extensive contact restrictions, as well as a ban on gatherings between 1st and 5th of April. An extended quiet time over Easter. The point is that over 5 consecutive days, people should stay at home.
Merkel urged citizens to refrain from any non-essential travel domestically and internationally. She said COVID cases are rising exponentially and intensive care beds are filling up again. Germany is also extending its general lockdown until April the 18th. That will reverse an earlier plan for a gradual reopening of the economy. In the past 24 hours, the country has reported nearly 7,500 new COVID cases and 250 related deaths. Germany is one of the hardest hit European nations by the pandemic. More than half of all UK adults have had their first COVID vaccination, with plans in place to immunize the entire population by the end of summer. Efforts are now underway to open large public events with COVID passports as a possible solution. But as Murtaza Jaffer reports, there is a growing backlash against such proposals. Here's more.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalising large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential four freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
North Korea has called on China to strengthen unity and cooperation between the two countries. In a verbal message to Beijing, North Korean leader Kim Jong-un praised his country's close ties with China and expressed hope to boost them further. He also called for intensifying the strategic communication between the two sides. Earlier on Monday, in a similar message, Chinese President Xi Jinping said his country is willing to work with Pyongyang to preserve peace and stability on the Korean Peninsula. The calls are seen as a clear message to Washington, as both have accused U.S. President Joe Biden of following in footsteps of his predecessor, Donald Trump. Jennifer Chang says U.S. President Joe Biden is continuing with his predecessor's maximum pressure and sanctions strategy on North Korea.
And the Biden administration is continuing the Trump administration's hardline policy of inflicting maximum sanctions and pressure on Pyongyang so far. So now North Korea is just waiting to see if the Biden administration is going to continue this kind of a hard line. Now, with China already, the Biden administration's Secretary of State, Blinken, has already had a verbal argument in public with the Chinese foreign minister in Alaska. And this also is exacerbating the whole situation with North Korea, because China is North Korea's main ally. And right now they are talking to each other about how they are going to defend themselves against the aggressive U.S. strategy.
A massive fire has swept through a Rohingya refugee camp in southern Bangladesh, forcing tens of thousands to flee. Bangladeshi officials say the blaze has displaced at least 50,000 refugees. They say seven people are also feared dead. The blaze broke out in Cox's Bazar on Monday. It is the largest in multiple fires that have hit Rohingya camps in the past months. The cause of the blaze has remained unknown despite investigations. Rohingya are Muslims from Myanmar. More than a million of them are currently living in overcrowded camps in the Cox's Bazar region. Most of them went there in 2017 following a Myanmar army crackdown on their community. Thousands have been evacuated as the worst flood in decades pummeled most parts of Australia. Authorities say 10 million people have been affected since floods began at the weekend. They say the New South Wales state is the worst hit, with about 18,000 moved to safety there. Another 15,000 are expected to be evacuated as well. No casualties have so far been reported. The downpour has washed away bridges and submerged houses. Authorities say the rain will start easing from late Wednesday. However, they say residents should not return to their homes immediately as the flood threat remains likely. The death toll from Sunday's gun attacks in Niger's Tahuha region has risen to 137. Security officials say the deaths occurred when armed men on motorbikes raided three villages near the border with Mali and Burkina Faso. A government spokesman said armed bandits now systematically target civilians and slammed the bloodshed as brutal and horrific. No group has yet claimed responsibility, but officials have blamed the attacks on Daesh terrorists and their affiliates. Violence has surged in the Niger border areas in recent weeks. On March the 15th, 66 people were killed in a similar raid in the Tillaberi region. Well, that's your world news for now.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The supplication on Tuesdays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, and praise is His right, since Him deserves it, abundant praise. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of my soul, for surely the soul commands to evil, except as my Lord has mercy. I seek refuge in Him from the evil of Satan, who adds sins to my sin. I seek protection with Him from every wicked tyrant and unjust sovereign and conquering enemy. O Allah, place me among Thy troops are the victors, and place me in Thy party, for Thy party are the ones who prosper. And place me among Thy friends, for Thy friends, no fear shall be upon them, nor shall they sorrow. O Allah, set right for me my religion, for it is the preserving tie of my affair. Set right for me my hereafter, for it is the abode of my permanent lodging. And to it I flee from the neighborhood of the vile. Make life an increase for me in every good, and death an ease for me from every evil. O Allah, bless Muhammad, the seal of the prophets, and the completion of the number of the envoys, and his household, the good, the pure, and his household, the good, the pure, and his companions, the distinguished. And give me on the Tuesday three things. Leave no sin for me unless Thou forgives it. And leave no grief unless Thou takes it away. And leave no enemy. And leave no enemy unless Thou repelst him. By means of in the name of Allah, the best of the names. In the name of Allah, Lord of earth and heaven, I seek to repulse every hateful thing, the first of which is his anger. And I seek to attract every lovable thing, the first of which is his good pleasure. So seal me with forgiveness from thee, O patron of beneficence.
Nowruz Special. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Nowruz is an ancient Iranian feast which has remained fresh for several millennia. If you remember, we briefly discussed myths and their relation with Nowruz. In continuation of the discussion, we are going to dwell upon the myths of the Sasanid era and the Islamic era, and we'll talk about the ways of holding Nowruz feasts in those eras. Stay tuned, please. The Sasanid kings ruled in Iran from 224 to 651 AD and were considered among the important empires in old times. In those days, Iran's official religion was Zoroastrianism, although Christian and Jewish minorities also lived in the country. Nowruz enjoyed a special position among the public and the authorities and used to be marked very gloriously. They used to celebrate Nowruz at least for 6 days. It contained the minor Nowruz and the major Nowruz. Before the start of the feast, there were other customs like house cleaning. And there was Sizdebedar custom, which was marked 1 week after the Nowruz days to end the spring celebrations. Iranians called the first 5 days of spring as the minor Nowruz. This period belonged to the public, and they could attend the presence of the kings. During these ceremonies, visitors would offer presents to the king, and after the 5 days, the major Nowruz started, which lasted only for 1 day. On this day, authorities like government officials would go to the palace, and then Nowruz celebrations would end. Nowruz, in those days, was so notable that it impacted even the music and poetry of the era. Thus, poets such as Manuchehri and Nezami composed poems on Nowruz. Traces of Nowruz can be found in the books of old writers too. They used to write much on decoration of homes and roofs and illuminating alleys and passages. There are accounts on the kinds of foods and drinks and the clothes of people too. After the Sasanid era, we reach the Islamic era. After the acceptance of Islam by the majority of Iranian people, Nowruz became a national feast with a religious tinge. The Umayyad and Abbasid caliphs at first paid little attention to Nowruz, but the peaceful nature of Nowruz and the way Iranians marked it made the rulers to accept it. The first independent dynasty which ruled Iran after the Sassanid kings was the Tahiri dynasty, which emerged in the Great Khorasan. In their era, Nowruz was celebrated very gloriously, and according to Abu Rayhan Biruni, the rulers of Khorasan in the 4th century AH used to give spring and summer garments to their troops in Nowruz. The Samanid and Ghaznavid rulers and rulers after them also marked Nowruz and other less important feasts. But after the Mongol onslaught, conditions totally changed in Iran. Nowruz, like many other traditions and customs, lost its significance and grandeur due to carnage and pillage that were rampant everywhere. However, Nowruz catapulted to fame once more, so that during the Safavid era, it turned again into a national and religious feast. Ever since, Iranians have preserved Nowruz like a precious heritage. Presently, Nowruz is celebrated gloriously in Iran and many countries with similar traditions and customs. One of the common customs is the spreading of haftsin tablecloth. As it was said earlier in this series, haftsin tablecloth consists of 7 items beginning with the Farsi letter sin, the equivalent of S in English. Each of these items symbolizes a phenomenon. Samanu, that is wheat sprout, pudding, is the symbol of bounty and plenitude. Somak or sumac is the symbol of sunrise. Sekke or coin is the symbol of wealth. Sip or apple is the symbol of beauty and health. Serke or vinegar is the symbol of patience and life. And sir or garlic is the symbol of treatment or medicine. Dear listeners, if you remember, we mentioned sabze or green sprouts, which symbolizes rebirth and revival, as another ingredient of this tablecloth, whereas senjet, that is oleaster fruit, is the inseparable part of this tablecloth, and it is the symbol of rationality and generation. One of the most important ingredients of haftsin tablecloth is a copy of the Noble Quran. Iranian Muslims start their new year in the name of God and remembrance of God. Iranian non-Muslims too put their holy book in the tablecloth as a source of blessing. Iranian Nowruz has survived the hard times during over 2,000 years. This great feast has united Iranians from all walks of life and every religion. The 9th day of this year's Nowruz has coincided with one of the greatest feasts of Muslims, namely the birth anniversary of the awaited savior of mankind, Imam Mahdi, peace upon him. May God help us be true followers to this Imam and prepare the ground for his reappearance. Amen. In lockstep with the spring, the season of renewal and freshness, and the greening of nature, we here at IRIB English Radio wish you happiness, prosperity, and good health.
News Bulletin.
Welcome to the Bulletin. My name's Amina Taylor, and we're broadcasting from the British capital. And it's here we begin our top story. Violent clashes between UK police and protesters over a proposed law making its way through the country's parliament. Now, if adopted, the so-called Police Crime Sentencing and Courts Bill will change the way protests are held in this country forever. And that has had campaigners and civil liberties groups up in arms as Saipur Reza fills us in.
Bristol, southwest England on the weekend. A peaceful march against government-proposed legislation that gives the police sweeping powers descended into violence. Some clashed with the police, others vented their anger and frustration in other ways. As darkness set in, the situation escalated further. Fireworks were thrown, police vans set on fire, several officers injured.
I'm opposed to violence of all kinds. That, yes, if there are people who are protesting being violent, I think that they are doing the wrong thing, because you don't need to be violent in every situation.
Peaceful protest, very much in support of, not in support of violence. And I'd be very interested to see the discussion about professional agitators, whether that's true. It certainly looked like it on TV.
But that doesn't take away from the seriousness of the government's Police, Crime, Sentencing and Courts Bill. And here is why it matters. Scenes on March 13th of women being manhandled by police officers while attending a peaceful vigil in memory of a young woman murdered allegedly by a police officer.
I think it's fundamentally wrong to stop people's right for protest, right from speaking out, because what other power do we have as a people? You know, that is our biggest power. And if you think of history, all the movements have happened, all the powerful change that was created through protest, through crowds, through gathering.
I get the intention, but I think it just gives the police too many powers, and I think their timing is also pretty poor, given you know, how the police are being viewed at the moment. They're losing an awful lot of support.
Having seen the way police broke up the vigil for Sarah Everard, whose murder acted as a poignant reminder about increasing male violence against women, campaigners are concerned about more powers for law enforcement, although the government took issue with the police treatment of the peaceful demonstrators.
Mr. Speaker, let me turn to this weekend's events. I've already said that some of the footage circulating online of Clapham Common is upsetting. So whilst the police are rightly operationally independent, I asked the Metropolitan Police for a report into what had happened.
Opposition parties and campaigners say the bill is deeply imbalanced, that it imposes gratuitous curbs on peaceful protests and does too little to protect women, that it introduces longer jail terms for vandalism, for defacing statues and memorials, than it does for rape.
The UK's Conservative government says the wide range of steps it's taking is necessary to keep people safe. Its new policing bill has already cleared the first parliamentary hurdle, and given the government's large parliamentary majority, it's almost guaranteed to become law, despite some libertarian concerns among its own MPs. Saipur Reza, London.
Well, author and political commentator John Wright joins us from Edinburgh. John, you've written about this very bill. May I ask you to quickly recap your thoughts?
Well, this bill is a panic reaction by the establishment to the wave of protests that took place last year across England and Wales, and starting with the toppling of the statue of Colston, attacking other monuments, statues of people associated historically with the British slave trade, and most prominently the defacing of Churchill's statue in Parliament Square in London. Because this establishment knows that after statues come tumbling down, often the wall of false consciousness follow. And so this is a rising wave of consciousness regarding Britain's role in the world past and present, and the Tory establishment is desperate to try and stem this rising tide of resistance and contesting of the official narrative of British history.
Is that how you would categorise what we saw in Bristol over the weekend?
Yes, I do. Karl Marx, it was who said, Amina, that necessity without consciousness is blind, and freedom is the consciousness of necessity. And those scenes, as ugly as they were, reflect the ugliness of the legislation involved, which arrogate to the police frightening new powers that would not look out of place in a totalitarian state. And, you know, it wasn't only the protesters who were violent. Some of the scenes, the pictures I've seen on social media, some of the footage shows that the police adopted a very heavy-handed approach, just as they did at the vigil to Sarah Everard, who was abducted and brutally murdered, allegedly by a serving police officer. So the optics could not be worse. People were sitting down in front of a police station, quietly, peacefully, and then the police arrived on horseback and in riot gear. So there was provocation, I think. I think the police in England especially have never been in a worse state in terms of public confidence, and I think this reflects a rising tide of consciousness as to this mob, the real mob that we're dealing with and people have to be scared of, which is in government.
Now, you say all of this, John, but yet the Conservatives enjoy good polling results. This despite the way in which some have said they've handled the pandemic, this proposed bill. What are we saying now about the opposition, but also about where people's minds are at a time like this?
This government's enjoying strong polling in England, not in Scotland. Let's make that clear. It does speak to a very weak opposition. Keir Starmer is an establishment man. He is Tory light, in my view. He's done his best to defenestrate Labour of its socialist policies under the Corbyn leadership that preceded him. But I think it speaks most prominently to the establishment or the introduction of US-style culture wars into the UK's political spectrum, into its narrative, over race, over ethnicity, over religion. And Brexit, of course, has unleashed a carnival of reaction. And Boris Johnson enjoys strong support from people who think Brexit is everything and is an end in itself. And, of course, nothing he can do will hamper that support, just as Donald Trump has a strong base despite all his criminal negligence and incompetence and racism and so forth. So the UK has never been more polarised, consensus nowhere, chaos everywhere, and I think it speaks to Britain's international, political and social decline. It's been a long time coming. This is just a tipping point, and I think we're in for a long, hot summer of social unrest in the UK.
A long, hot summer. All bit of social unrest. Thank you so much, John White.
This is European News Bulletin broadcast by IRIB English Radio. In this program, we covered the most recent developments all over Europe. You can listen to this program on Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, Thursday, and Saturday.
Now, Richard Sudan, we saw those scenes. We've heard what Saeed Poureza and John White had to say about their particular views on what took place over the weekend. Your stance?
So it's interesting, Amina, and social media is awash with debate and different reactions. And I want to take a look at this first headline, which says, "Police chief condemns the violence and destruction as 20 officers are injured." Now, the reason we've chosen this headline is because the media establishment, if you like, have largely ran with this narrative, talking about the destruction of police vans and, of course, the injuries to police officers. Now, the reaction is mixed on social media, but a lot of people are basically saying that the government is going to, of course, spin this in their favour to make the argument that the bill must, of course, be pushed through. And actually, what's interesting also is a lot of people, Amina, are frankly sceptical and are asking questions about the minority element of these protests, which actually caused the destruction. People are saying, look, we've seen in the past examples where demonstrations have been infiltrated with the sole intention of making the protest turn violent, precisely to spin in the government's favour. So you've seen one narrative, if you like, from the mainstream media, but actually many users on social media are very much aware of the potentiality for other narratives, if you like, to have taken place. And certainly that's what's being discussed online at the moment.
All right, let's hear what they have to say in their own words.
Let's go first to David Holt, who comes from the other side, if you like. David Holt says, "We are under attack from leftism. They cannot cope with their constant failures, so they turn to violence." McArdle says presumably there are undercover police who've infiltrated anarchist and extremist groups who can now torch property to kick off a riot and not face prosecution. Just part of the job. And we have a reaction from Moomin, who says, I've not seen any footage of the Bristol riots. I'm anti-violence and find that stuff depressing. That said, people are angry. Angry with the police bill, angry with the regime corruption, and fuming at police assaulting innocent women last week. It's not right, but perhaps understandable. So this debate is really raging online at the moment, Amina.
Right, and we move across the Atlantic for the second wave of a very disturbing story. The murder a few days back of 8 people in a particular part of Atlanta. And just fill us in on what happened and why it's important. Why have you chosen this story?
Absolutely. So our headline talks about the Atlanta Spa shooting, and Robert Arrett Long, who this headline is now talking about, has been kicked out of a Georgia church. So what's interesting is there have been a number of things, really, which people are saying are humanizing this man. This headline talks about the fact he was a church goer. One of the police chiefs actually said that Robert Aaron Long had a bad day. There's other news pieces talking about him being a kind of nerdy, quiet, shy, geeky guy at school. But I think the point here for a lot of people is that, you know, for a long time over the last few weeks, we've seen the narrative that black people have been attacking Asian people in the Asian community. And here is an example of Robert Aaron Long, a conservative guy from a rural part of Georgia, massacring 8 people for which he's been charged. 6 of them are Asian Americans, and many people are saying this is the definition of a hate crime. Other people are saying this is an example of a domestic act of terrorism, and they are saying that the media is reluctant to really diagnose it thusly. And so there's a kind of difference, if you like, between what people are saying is the actual reality and the narrative again being pushed by sort of sections of the media. And people are saying, look, let's just call it what it is.
And indeed, if it was anyone else, and what's social media calling it, Richard, today?
Okay, let's go first to Philip Walker, who says, you can look no further than the sudden false narrative that black people are targeting Asians. Meanwhile, white supremacist operatives like Robert Aaron Long are massacring Asians en masse. Bishop Talbot Swan says, while America tries to paint a black face on anti-Asian violence, a white supremacist, Robert Arrett Long, murders 8 Asians in Atlanta, and authorities won't call him a terrorist. They're mentioning sex addiction and saying they don't know the motive. And US Political Theater says, did the police also take domestic terrorist Robert Arrett Long to Burger King for lunch, like they did with domestic terrorist neo-Nazi Dylan Roof, after he murdered 9 black people in a church?
Well, leave it there, Richard Sudan. Thank you. Now, Palestine has begun administering the first doses of the COVID-19 vaccine it's received from the global COVAX initiative to healthcare workers and older residents in the occupied West Bank and Gaza Strip. The United Nations-backed COVAX program delivered some 61,400 vaccines to the Palestinian Authority, with 21,300 jabs also being shipped to the besieged Gaza Strip. The news comes months after the Palestinian Authority blasted the Israeli regime for its decision to block vital vaccines from being delivered to the impoverished West Bank and Gaza Strip. Amnesty International and the World Health Organization have also joined in their calls to Israel, asking Tel Aviv to stop ignoring its international obligations as an occupying power and ensure the fair distribution of vaccines to Palestinians. 5 of Europe's southern states have stepped up calls for help and solidarity to other EU countries in managing the mass influx of refugees from entering the bloc. Interior ministers from Italy, Spain, Malta, Cyprus and Greece met over the weekend to discuss the issue and hash out a new migration pact, which would share the burden of mass migration with other members of the bloc. Thousands of refugees fleeing from Western-backed wars in places like Libya and Syria have died in the perilous maritime journey to reach EU shores. Critics of the EU have previously accused the 27-nation bloc of evading its responsibilities towards people making the journeys. More than half of all the UK adults have had their first COVID vaccination, with plans in place to immunize the entire adult population by the end of the summer. Efforts are now underway to open large public events with COVID passports as a possible solution. But as Murtaza Jaffa reports, there is a growing backlash against such proposals.
As the UK races ahead with its vaccine rollout, discussions have turned to normalising large public gatherings such as sports events, cinemas and theatre shows. Britain's Culture Secretary, Oliver Dowden, has revealed that the government are now considering COVID passports to allow people to attend large-scale public events from June the 21st.
We'll be testing whether we can use COVID certification to help facilitate the return of sports. Obviously, final decisions have not been taken on that, and I'm working with the Chancellor of the Duchy of Lancaster, Michael Gove, who is leading on our COVID certification work programme. But I think that is a potential tool that could help the return of the things that we love.
Campaigners have been quick to push back against such proposals, adamant such a move would restrict people's right to refuse any form of vaccination. More than 300,000 people have signed a petition against COVID passports, citing MP Nadeem Zahawi, the secretary in charge of the vaccine rollout, who said there were no plans for vaccine passports back in December 2020. Last week's unease over potential blood clots being linked to the Oxford AstraZeneca vaccine added more anxiety. In Brussels, the EU have announced similar proposals to facilitate freedom of movement within the bloc. Their digital green certificate would allow their 450 million residents to travel freely between nation states, one of the essential four freedoms that make up the European Union. This has become critical as a third wave of infections continues to spread. The digital green certificates will apply to tourists also. British holidaymakers who've been quick to book their European getaways are finding themselves having to get vaccines and COVID passports before travelling. Turkey, however, have come out and declared they will not be imposing such criteria, a marketing ploy designed to attract vaccine-weary holidaymakers. Concerns over vaccines and human rights will remain ongoing. Anti-vax campaigners will continue their crusade, but those in the entertainment industry, as well as countries reliant on tourism, will be desperate to get their economies back up and running. In this vein, many feel vaccine passports will ultimately become part of the new normal.
Earlier today, ministers from the European Union met in Brussels to discuss the bloc's relations with Turkey and Russia. High on the agenda will be the ongoing dispute over hydrocarbon resources in the Eastern Mediterranean Sea between Turkey, Cyprus and Greece. Other points of discussion will include the Turkish detention of Kurdish politicians, as well as the imprisonment of Russian opposition figure Alexei Navalny. The meeting comes weeks after the 27-nation bloc announced it would be slapping retaliatory sanctions on Moscow over the Navalny case. Following their statement, Russia accused the bloc of interfering in the country's internal affairs. Robert in Lakesh, welcome back to the Bulletin. We're going to kick things off with, dare I say, some more misinformation being directed about Iran from Washington. Take it away.
Well, this time we see the report coming from The Hill. A number of different United States outlets, of course, take the words of U.S. Intelligence officers, as they call them, verbatim, no matter what they're saying. We're seeing this again in the case of this report, where they're saying that Iran had discussed a plan to attack a U.S. Army base in Washington, D.C. They cite two unnamed officials, and it's key that they are unnamed. There was no comment when they tried to reach out to the Pentagon and to intelligence agencies to verify these claims. But many people are pointing out that this comes at a crucial time when the Biden administration is attempting to get itself away from the responsibility which it pledged itself to, that is getting back into the JCPOA or Iran nuclear deal. And on top of that as well, it looks like the Biden administration is poised to launch more strikes against the PMU, perhaps in Syria or in Iraq, again, as it did last month after an attack which targeted U.S. forces not linked to Iran. But of course, the U.S. media helped manufacture that dissent when it came to the retaliation, as it was called, which came to a group which was completely irrelevant to the strikes in the country.
So the easiest way now to justify your foreign policy is to just say Iran, whatever.
Absolutely, and we're seeing that reports like this are surfacing all the time when the Biden administration has pressure applied to it to try and get something achieved. And in this case, a promise which the Biden administration pledged, and that was to attempt to get back into the Iran nuclear deal, which they have not done. This is a foreign policy layup, as it has been called and described by many analysts. And we're seeing that Joe Biden has completely ignored this.
All right. What's been the online reaction to this story, Robert?
The first we've got here is from Hamid Marandi, who says, "The obedient American media mimics whatever garbage intelligence agencies tell them. They did that before the aggression against Iraq. They did that before bombing and destroying Libya. They did that regularly in Syria to justify aiding Al-Qaeda and illegal military strikes. Never ending," he says. And we've got another one here from journalist Max Blumenthal, who says, "The national security state is fabricating threats to overpower local opposition to further militarization of D.C. First, the bogus threat of QAnon attacks, then this month to justify extending the National Guard occupation of Capitol Hill, and now this."
Okay, we move on to, well, some would say an inevitability in Israeli politics. New elections in just, what, 2 days?
Yes, we will see the elections on this Tuesday coming, and a lot of people, of course, in disarray as things can only get worse from here for Palestinians. It seems that Netanyahu has successfully divided up his opposition. Former opposition member Benny Gantz of the Blue and White Party essentially has been destroyed in the polls. We're seeing that he will not even, or his party will barely make it into the Israeli Knesset this time around. And last time, Netanyahu had 4 opposition parties against him. Now he has 10. So his bid to divide has been successful. And on top of that, he's aligning himself with right-wing racist groups, the likes of which are Otzma Yehudit, or Jewish Power, as it's known in English, which essentially has been compared to the KKK because of its hardline racist views. Its leader, in fact, was convicted in 2007 of supporting a terrorist organization and inciting racism. And so when we talk about the Palestinians in this instance, we're seeing that if Netanyahu gets in, he's aligned with these far-right racist parties. And then if his opposition win as well, the number one figure against him is a man named Gideon Saar. Also, things are not looking good for the Palestinians because Gideon Saar is even more hardline than Netanyahu when it comes to the Palestinian issue and calls for the expulsion of Palestinians.
Tweets?
The first we've got here is from an Israeli actually commenting on this. They say 55,000 people last night all yelling, "Go, leave us alone to start rebuilding our lives and our country," a demonstration of power protest and a call for change to remove corrupted Netanyahu and his messengers from power. Elections in 2 days. So an unhappy Israeli there. Then we have another one here as well commenting on the issue of Netanyahu's being aligned to these racist parties. Says Netanyahu allies with extremist party denounced by many American groups, APACs actually included in that, who are openly calling for the ethnic cleansing of Palestinians.
And this is a man who's facing charges. I don't understand why he's even allowed to run briefly, Robert.
Well, this victory will mean that he can attempt to get past a bill which would essentially mean that the charges being brought against him would be dropped. So for him, this is a crucial victory to win, and that's why we're seeing him align so he can get those 61 seats in the Knesset and win.
Well, anything to save your skin, some might say. Robert Inlakesh, thank you, and thank you for being with us for this broadcast. Until next time.
in the limelight.
One day after a spring break, Oasis of South Beach descended into chaos, with the police struggling to control overwhelming crowds and making scores of arrests. Officials in Miami Beach decided on Sunday, 21st of March, to extend an emergency curfew for up to 3 weeks. The police fired pepper balls to disperse crowds after an 8 p.m. curfew went into effect on Saturday, 20th of March. Local Miami officials said people had flocked to the city of Miami because of its relatively few coronavirus restrictions. The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Neil Vigder and Azzy Pabera. The piece is titled Miami Beach, Overwhelmed by Spring Break, Extends Emergency Curfew. Stay with us for more of Neil Vigder and Azzy Pabera's article. One day after the spring break, Oasis of South Beach descended into chaos, with the police struggling to control overwhelming crowds and making scores of arrests. Officials in Miami Beach decided on Sunday, 21st of March, to extend an emergency curfew for up to 3 weeks. The police fired pepper balls.